Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, we recently did a show on one of the enduring mysteries of the 20th century, which is the question of what happened to Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, on their around-the-world flight attempt in July 1937. They fell off the grid out over the South Pacific and just disappeared. To recap, for those of you who might not have heard that show or followed developments in the story in recent years, the leading theory at present is that they crash-landed on a shallow-water reef just off a small island in the South Pacific that was then called Gardner Island, but is now called Nikumaroro. I think I said that right. A group called TIGER, which stands for the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, and they do aviation archaeology, has been trying for years to find definitive evidence and solve the mystery. They've made progress and might be very close to proving what happened. They learned that in 1940, at what appeared to be an old campsite on the beach on that island, a British surveying party found the heel of a woman's shoe, of the type that Earhart wore. A sextant box was found for the type of navigational instrument that Noonan liked to use, her navigator, and it was kind of an unusual old type. And searching the same site several years ago, TIGER found a small bottle that apparently held a cosmetic that Earhart used to cover her freckles, as well as a bottle of Benedictine, which she was known to drink. She'd smuggle one on her plane and take it on her flight, so those are all kind of, you know, circumstantial evidence that's pretty strong, right? So TIGER also ran across, a little later, a photo of the island taken by a British Navy officer in 1940, in which an object can be seen sticking up out of the reef that TIGER thinks was a landing gear off Earhart's plane, and a while later it was gone. And their sonar has, more recently, detected a large object resting on the bottom at 600 feet off the edge of the shallow reef, but they haven't been able to reach it. But perhaps the most intriguing of all of these things were some human bones that were found at that site in 1940. And they were examined by a pathologist in Fiji at that time, who concluded that they had belonged to a short European man, or perhaps a South Sea Islander. His autopsy report survives, but unfortunately the bones themselves were lost. And this is where my guest this week comes in. He is Dr. Richard Jantz, a professor emeritus of anthropology and former director emeritus of the Forensic Anthropology Center at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. He's recently made significant progress in solving the mystery of the bones, and therefore of Amelia Earhart's fate, and has published his findings recently in the journal Forensic Anthropology. Welcome, Dr. Jantz.
Well, thank you, Court. I'm always happy to talk about Amelia Earhart.
We're glad to have you here on the show talking about it. So can we call you Richard?
You may call me Richard.
So why don't we just start by asking you to give us the background on the bones, starting with, you know, beyond what I said, what they were and what happened to them after they were found in 1940.
Well, the bones came to light because a native worker found a skull. It was buried. Then it was called to the attention of the administrator, Gerald Gallagher, and he ordered a search, and 13 bones were found. And they consisted of a skull, a mandible, a humerus, that's the upper arm, a radius of one of the bones in the lower arm, both femora, the upper leg, a right tibia and fibula, plus some smaller bones. So it wasn't a bad representation of the skeleton. Mm-hmm. And if we had it now, we could do a lot with it. But the bones were then, as you pointed out, sent to Fiji, where they were examined by Dr. D.W. Hoodless. And at the time they were found, they were thought possibly to be the remains of Amelia Earhart, primarily because of the woman's shoe and the artifacts that were associated. But Dr. Hoodless said the remains belonged to a male, and that basically closed the case. And after he submitted his report, he was told to retain the bones until further notice, and that's the last we've heard of them. What's happened to the bones, we do not know.
Yeah, too bad. So how did Dr. Hoodless arrive at his key conclusion that the bones belonged to a man, which basically threw everybody off? You know, that was the end of the story then, right, as far as everybody was concerned?
Well, sure, that was the end of the story as far as the English were concerned. He used three criteria to establish sex, and I should say here that his report is quite perfunctory. It doesn't give a lot of detail, but the three things he used were the half subpubic angle. He used the half subpubic angle because there was only one innominate or hip bone. The subpubic angle is wider in females and narrower in males, and that's a consequence of adaptation for childbirth. Mm. Then he used what he called the set of the femora, and that was something I really wasn't familiar with, but I have inferred that it means the angle that the femora made with the hip bone. And then the other thing he used was the ratio of the circumferences of the bones to their lengths. So those three criteria he set out as his sexing criteria. And the subpubic angle would be something we would use now. The other two things we would not use for sexing because they're not efficient sexing criteria. And we do not really have any idea how he weighted those three things. He just says he uses them. So presumably he gave them equal weight or gave some weight to these inefficient sexers. Otherwise he wouldn't have mentioned them. So that's basically what we know about how he arrived at the male sex. He doesn't give any numbers. He doesn't describe anything. He just says, I use these two sex, the remains.
But he did give precise measurements, I assume, of the bones that you could then use later on. And we should interject here that if people are familiar with the way Amelia Earhart looked, she wasn't Mae West, right? She wasn't a shapely woman. She was tall and slender. She was kind of boyish looking, really, and she was fairly tall and slender. So to use standard female measurements to kind of sort of analyze these bones probably was off base to start with, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I would say that. She was quite narrow-bodied for a female. Exactly how that would translate into the pelvis morphology, I don't think we have a good grasp of that. It's certainly conceivable that her pelvis did not look especially female. And there's an interesting little aside that I might mention here, and that is that there has been secular change, that is, change through time, in pelvic morphology. And modern women look more female than women of the 19th century. Given that, it would not be at all surprising for Hoodless to have considered her subpubic angle more male or at least ambiguous.
Interesting, but he did give precise measurements, at least, of the bones that he had. Whether he analyzed them correctly or applied the right criteria to them, at least you had numbers you could deal with in that sense, right?
We had some numbers. Unfortunately, he did not measure the femora. There's no explanation given for that. So the measurements we have are the length of the humerus, the radius, the tibia. And then there were four measurements on the skull, length and breadth of the vault, and height and width of the eye orbits. Those are the measurements we have to work with.
Pretty minimal. I mean, it would have been nice if he'd have taken a photograph of the bones laid out, right?
But anyway. It would have been wonderful, yeah. A photograph, yeah. A more elaborate explanation.
Yeah.
But it's almost like he knew what answer he was supposed to give and gave that answer.
Huh. So you're talking about, I don't even know if he was really a pathologist, but anyway, a doctor in Fiji. I kind of picture him sitting there with a Mai Tai alongside his table or something, kind of knocking this off on a Friday night and going, hey, time for a party or something. Who knows?
Yeah, you would not call him a pathologist.
Okay.
He was a physician.
All right. Huh.
I would say he knew quite a bit about bone assessment for a physician at the time. But it's also important to point out that forensic anthropology was an infant science at the time.
Sure.
So no one knew that much about human skeletal variation and how to interpret it and so on.
Yeah, so, you know, it was 80 years ago and it was in Fiji, so you have to kind of put that in context and be glad we got something at all. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis, and we're talking with Dr. Richard Jantz, who is a forensic anthropologist, which is an unusual specialty of anthropology that I guess we may get into later about exactly what that is, but I assume it's like forensic medicine. You're looking for the sources of the background of a crime or possibly some sort of an unusual death. And so now here we're 80 years later, beyond the time that Dr. Hoodless did his cursory examination and analysis of those bones. And so you don't have the bones, you've only got minimal information from him. But what new technology did you use, Richard, in your research that wouldn't have been available to him in 1940?
Well, there are basically two things that I had that he did not have. One of them is access to a large skeletal database, and the other is data processing. I could do a statistical analysis of the measurements he provided by comparing it to the measurements in our database, and he would not have had any of that information available.
Hmm. So what do you find then from those technologies and those resources that he didn't have?
What I ended up doing was comparing the bone measurements, the tibia, the humerus and radius measurements of the Nakumarora bones, two estimates that I was able to make from a photograph of Amelia Earhart. The photograph of Amelia Earhart had a scalable object in it, and I could actually get approximate measurements, I will say, but probably pretty good, of the length of her humerus and the length of her radius. And the length of her tibia was estimated in a somewhat different way, using the inseam of her trousers. So you had here a more or less typical forensic situation where you have remains and you have someone you make the comparison. So that's what I did, and that's how I arrived at the conclusion that the bones from Nakumarora Island are a very good fit to Amelia Earhart.
You mentioned using her trousers. Did you find the trousers and make those measurements? I mean, how did you go about that process, that side of your forensics in it?
Well, that's another aspect of the help I got from Tiger on this. Purdue University, with which Amelia Earhart was affiliated and I think sponsored some of her activities, has a collection of Amelia Earhart's memorabilia. And they have her trousers, a jacket, her flight helmet, things like that. And a historic seamstress, Paula Guernsey, took extensive measurements on the clothing and provided those to me.
Were they clothes that you could see her wearing in any extant photo, or you knew they were her clothes?
She's shown wearing them in a photo, yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that was not the photo I used to get the measurements, but you can clearly see how the trousers fit her.
Yeah, because you'd have to see, whether they sagged below her hip area or how long they were on her shoes or short or what, so that would be part of what you'd
have. Sure, and you could see that they ended about the level of an ankle, so I could see the end point of the trousers, and with the inseam, that has a pretty high correlation with the length of the leg. And that's how I got the tibia length estimate.
So in particular, in your article in Forensic Anthropology, you're sure that she's that the bones were highly likely to be, or certainly highly possible to be those of a woman. So what made you think that Hoodless was wrong in his clear, definite conclusion that the bones had to be those of a man?
Well, in the analysis I did, I didn't really include sex as a variable. So I compared her to both males and females. And either way, there are very few individuals in our database which numbered well over 2,000 individuals that have a similarity to Amelia Earhart. So what that means is that if you take a random person of either sex, that person will not look like Amelia Earhart. There were like, out of the females in our database, there were probably three that were as similar to Amelia as the Nakumarora bones, and maybe another dozen males out of 1,500 or something like that. So if you just drop a random individual onto Nakumarora Island, that random individual would have a low probability of fitting the bone lengths of Amelia Earhart.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's the basis of the probability that I derive that it's likely to be her.
Yeah, I understand that logic. You know, there is one wrinkle though that some years before, I guess it was 1929, even though this island, I said Nikumaroro, I guess you're pronouncing it Nikumaroro, I don't know, that island, whatever it is a small island, right? A small island, and a ship, a pretty good-sized tanker ship, basically called the Norwich City, I guess it was British flagged, maybe, I'm not sure, but wrecked on, on the reef that fringes this island, that the theory is that she landed her plane on when she was about to run out of gas. And so this large ship wrecked, and there were, I think, 11 crewmen aboard, and they all died. I mean, it was basically a desert island, even though there were trees on it. It wasn't a desert, but there was no water, and it was a small island. So it was the classic desert island, I guess, kind of thing. But those 11 men were never recovered. So there is the possibility was in the air that the bones were maybe one of them that had set up a campsite and then, you know, died of exposure or whatever later on. And so that possibility was kind of there. And I guess also because it's in the South Pacific and the islanders in the region, even though the islands are separated by a long distance from each other, they travel around a lot by sailboat. And so there was that possibility that was the bones of a Pacific Islander. So did you eliminate those possibilities just by the same sort of statistical analysis that you just went through a minute ago?
Well, I can acknowledge that I do not have Micronesian or Polynesian bone measurements so that I could make that comparison. As far as the crew of the Norwich City, that consisted of both English and Yamani Arabs.
Okay.
And I'm going to assume credibly that if it were an Englishman, that Englishman would not differ a lot from an American.
Mm-hmm.
And would have the same low probability of looking like Amelia Earhart.
Right.
The Yamani people of the time were quite short and had rounder heads, wider, shorter heads than Europeans. And the Nakumarora skull is relatively long and narrow. So I think it's unlikely that either an English or a Yamani survivor, if there happened to be one, would look like Amelia Earhart. And you also have to consider context. So if it were a Norwich City survivor, that's not a parsimonious explanation, because that person wouldn't have had a Benedictine bottle, wouldn't have had a sextant box.
Or a woman's shoe.
Or a woman's shoe or any of that.
Yeah.
So it would require two independent events, really.
Right. Right.
It would require somehow these artifacts got there for one event, and somehow the skeleton got there as another event.
Yeah.
So you have to consider the context. That's what we always do, because the context can rule in or out certain possibilities.
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So you come to the conclusion in your paper that, and I'm going to quote here, until definitive evidence is presented that the remains are not those of Amelia Earhart, the most convincing argument is that they are hers. And that sounds reasonable. You found that the bones are more similar to Earhart's bones than they are to 99% of individuals in the large reference sample of people you were talking about. So I guess really what it boils down to is that you're saying that now the ball's in the court of anyone else who thinks that you're wrong to prove it. Is that a fair statement?
I think that's a fair statement. My view of this whole thing is that it ought to take place within the scientific framework. The way I would frame it is as follows. I put forth the hypothesis that, or let us say I tested the hypothesis that the bones on the Kumarara Island belong to Amelia Earhart. So based on the evidence, I could accept or reject that hypothesis. And I think the evidence supports that hypothesis. And it's not enough, in my opinion, for critics to just say, well, you didn't consider North City. You didn't consider an islander. I think if you're going to make a credible argument that the bones on the Kumarara Island are not Earhart's, you have to put forth some scientific evidence that supports that. And I do not believe that has been done. And, you know, so much of this conversation takes place on chat lines and listservs and things like that, where you can just say whatever you want.
Sure.
So if someone wants to make a credible argument using scientific methods that supports some other hypothesis or fails to support mine, then I welcome that, because that's how we move forward. But just to get on chat lines and say, well, you didn't consider this, you didn't consider that, is not very helpful.
Yeah, no, I got you. Your conclusions are solidly grounded, and you challenge anybody else to come up with something equally solidly grounded, but it doesn't seem likely to you, and I understand it doesn't seem likely to me either, really. So, well, here's a kind of a speculative question, you know, and it almost certainly isn't going to happen, but if the bones were, there's another tool, theoretically, that you have that they didn't have 80 years ago. So if the bones were to somehow magically reappear, DNA analysis be useful on them after all this time, and especially given the 3 years they sat on a beach in the tropics being picked over by crabs and what have you?
I guess the answer to that is we won't know how much DNA could be recovered until we find the bones.
There you go.
And it is the case that DNA survives much less well in tropical environments than it does in Arctic environments. So they're finding DNA in Neanderthal bones, for example, 60, 70, 80,000 years old. But in tropical environments, it doesn't last as long. That isn't to say they couldn't find some. If the bones are well enough preserved, they may well be able to extract something from that. But I would also say that if the bones did materialize, we might not need DNA, because there are some things we know about Amelia Earhart that would potentially allow us to make an identification. For example, she's known to have had sinus problems and had a surgical procedure that it's a Caldwell-Luke procedure that would have modified the morphology of her facial bones.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So we could conceivably make an identification with just that.
Yeah, sure.
And we would also have additional measurements that we could use to further compare the bones to Amelia Earhart.
Well, that would be a problem you'd love to have, but it isn't going to happen almost certainly. So But anyway, we're kind of at the end of the show here, Dr. Chance, and I do want to say that as it happens, as this show is being aired, Dr. Robert Ballard, the famed deep-sea explorer who discovered the wreck of the Titanic in 1985, is leading an expedition to Nikumaroro, to that island, to locate and view the deep-water object offshore of the island that I mentioned at the beginning. And the expedition is being funded by National Geographic and will result in a two-hour special to air on the Nat Geo channel this October. You know how they do those things where it's the big unveiling, right? But I suspect if they find anything, because this is the expedition's going on now, I suspect the news will come out pretty quickly if they find the plane at the bottom of that reef cliff. But the show will be called Expedition Amelia. And Bob Ballard is convinced that that Nikumaroro is where Earhart ended up. He's somebody who's in that business, and he's not easily fooled, and he's convinced that that's where that plane is going to be found. Not her, but the plane. So part of their expedition will be to search for more bones at the beach campsite. And just one last question here with just the few seconds we have left. Richard, have they been in touch with you about their search at all?
Not just generally.
Okay.
I know that they're searching, and I've talked a little bit with Tom King about it, but that's all I really know.
Well, if he's, I guess if they do find any more bones on the beach, I suspect they'll be ringing your phone at that point, I think. And if not, they certainly should. So just very briefly, if you can, so what if, I kind of alluded to it, but I didn't describe it well, I'm sure. So what do forensic anthropologists do, Richard?
Well, forensic anthropologists are experts in examining human remains that are too far gone for a forensic pathologist to examine. Mm. So if a murder victim that gets killed in a nightclub bar or something like that, that victim will go to a forensic pathologist. They will do an autopsy. But if that victim is left out in the woods and decomposes to the point where there are skeletal remains or to the point where a forensic pathologist can't say anything, that's where forensic anthropologists come in.
Okay.
So we do things like estimate time since death. We develop a biological profile. We say this is a male or a female, 40 or 50 years old, 5 feet, 8 inches tall, and so on. And it gives law enforcement a description of the kind of person they need to look for.
Well, that's pretty interesting. And I suspect we're going to find out more soon about the final resting place of Amelia Earhart and solve that mystery after 80 years. It's going to be interesting sometime in the next couple months, if not then by October anyway.
I agree, and I hope so.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being on with us, Dr. Richard Jantz. This has been interesting, and we will all keep our ears tuned to what else comes of this story in the near future. And I want to thank all of you out there for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.